From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Joy Powers. Today on the show, race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell hosts a virtual roundtable discussion with local community and political leaders to give some context to this week's protests.
We're spending so much time focusing on the uprising and people who are out in the streets and who are causing ruckus. Why don't we put that same energy in changing these institutions and systems and structures that perpetuated the problem in the first place?
Then we hear a special edition of NPR's podcast, Code Switch, which examines the country's reaction to the death of George Floyd and other African Americans at the hands of police.
America is still taking its sweet time in even recognizing our humanity in terms of its laws, in terms of its mores, in terms of its practices.
Plus, a poem about privilege. Lake Effect Weekend is next, but first, the news. This is Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for tuning in today. I'm Joy Powers. The phrase Black Lives Matter is once again echoing through the streets of our country, following the death of another black man at the hands of police. People are protesting the death of George Floyd in Minneapolis. He died after a police held his knee on Floyd's neck for nearly 9 minutes as he lay face down on the pavement during an arrest. Protesters in Milwaukee are also marching for Joel Acevedo, who was killed by an off-duty Milwaukee police officer in April. The protests have been ongoing since last weekend. And while most gatherings have been peaceful, police have fired tear gas at unarmed protesters, and there has been some looting and vandalism. WUWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell held a virtual roundtable discussion with local community and political leaders for their perspectives on what the country and Milwaukee is witnessing. Taryn was joined by Marquesa Tucker of the African American Roundtable, State Senator Lena Taylor, and Jamal Smith of the Office of Violence Prevention in a Zoom call.
So here we are again, another moment in history where we are witnessing the frustration of Black men and women, Latino men and women, coming out through protests and riots over being brutalized and murdered by police or anyone else who hates them just for the color of their skin. And it's been several days at this point, locally, nationally, and internationally. What do you all have to say about what's happening right now? What is Milwaukee? What is this country going through? Marquesa, you can start.
Sure, absolutely. We're going through the consequences of white supremacy not being addressed, racism not being addressed, divestment from communities not being addressed, the school-to-prison pipeline not being addressed. Excuse me, I lost my voice from a rally on Friday. You know, there's just a list that goes on over policing, you know, still trying to move through a police department and police systems that have been built on slavery. You know, we haven't addressed so much, so I don't know why people would think anything else would be the response to so many things that have not been addressed. And the consequences are what we are seeing before us. So people can point blame and say, oh, they shouldn't be looting. Oh, they shouldn't be rioting. Oh, well, you should have responded before now. And now is a moment in time where the attention is on all of these areas where folks are uprising in response to being sick and tired of being doggone sick and tired. You know, I was watching a couple of different videos. How much patience, how much kindness do they want Black people to have? Like Black people, you know, the people always say, Black people have been so nice. They've been so kind. You know, they are so forgiving. How long? You know, and I serve a just God. So I know that his justice is what is going to happen. Like you can't continue to roll over and mess over people for generations after generations before something has to change. So I'm happy to see the uprisings and for people speaking up and coming out of their houses. And I'm ready to be a part of organizing and leading them towards a more strategic direction around how we can begin to create our own alternatives, have demands that are going to change the policies and the different systems that we have to live in currently.
It's everything that Marquesa said. Right? We have to continuously evaluate the impact of systemic, structural, and institutional racism and how that has continuously been perpetuated on Black folks throughout generations. And at some point, you know, I don't understand why there's continuously this request that Black folks be civil when there's when there's incivility happening towards us. So we're supposed to be respectful while not being respected at the same time. I saw a sign yesterday that I agree with. It said, respect existence or expect resistance. And I think that's one of the most profound signs and messages
I've ever heard. Say that one more time.
It was respect existence or expect resistance. So how much further do we have to keep asking for respect for us as not only just as Black folks, but just as human beings, period. Now we're getting tired of asking for something that we fundamentally have a right for. And now what you're seeing is the result of that anger and that pain. So we're spending so much time focusing on the uprising and people who are out in the streets and who are causing ruckus. Why don't we put that same energy in changing these institutions and systems and structures that perpetuated the problem in the first place?
And like a number of cities, Milwaukee has been here before. I think this moment might likely remind folks about the Sherman Park unrest, specifically in 2016, after Sylvia Smith died at the hands of police. Just looking at how things are unfolding in Milwaukee, both in response to George Floyd's death in Minnesota and Joel Acevedo's death here, as a Black Milwaukeean, how does this make you feel?
Like I said, it makes me feel proud. It makes me feel like, thank God I'm in this moment. You know, thank God that I'm in this season to be able to witness what is happening, but also be, like I said, a part of how we strategically move forward to get what we want, to help to channel this energy in a direction that is going to get us some wins. Like, we don't say that, you know, we will win and, you know, all of these chants just to be saying, I'm like, we believe that in our hearts that we will win. And in order to do that, we can take the energy that we see currently and the energy on the side where I am, which is now around strategy, and bring those two together and continue to develop leaders so that I don't have to be the only other person. Jamal doesn't have to be the only person. Block and Metcalf, they don't have to be these only groups. And Lit leading out in these extremely difficult times, like Block hasn't even been able to respond at all, just because this is what they do day in and day out. So we have to be strategic around creating visions and leading people in that direction, but also developing leaders. This is making me excited because I see leaders everywhere, and I see this as an opportune time to bring those people in that, you know, as many people as we can bring around us and gather and create spaces to educate people around the tools that they'll need to move forward to get the results they want. So this makes me really excited. It makes me excited.
What I'll add to that is, and the leaders are not going to be, they're not going to fit a certain look or a stereotypical look that most people would expect a leader to be. We got people who are, you know, just right on the block that are ready to get out and do work. We got people who are in the middle of some of these neighborhoods that are most challenging that are ready to get out here and do work. So we got to understand that this collaboration is going to be a marriage of people who may not have been a part of the work, who wouldn't be the ideal or considered the so-called ideal person to lead. Those are the ones that should be leading the most because they are experiencing this trauma regularly every day. So we know that every form of racism has to be addressed by all of us. And we cannot continuously think that it's just going to come from some leadership here, from some of the organizations that, you know, Marquesa mentioned, and, you know, that have been pounding the pavement, some of the work that Senator Taylor is doing. This is going to take a massive, critical mass of people to be a part of this work. And the fact that we're seeing so many people who are coming out and saying, you know what, I am tired of this, I totally agree with Marquesa. This is beautiful to watch. It's beautiful to watch. It's beautiful to see people stepping up and emerging as leaders in their own neighborhoods and just overall around these issues.
I would like to speak to that. It's also frustrating because we just had an election, and I wanted to ask all the people that were out. Yeah, you may shake your head no. I felt no to some of the things you said too, Marquesa. But some of the people that didn't come out to vote, it's frustrating because we don't understand. We don't understand civics. And so we don't often understand the power that we already have, and we don't execute the power that we already have because we, one, haven't been taught that in school. We haven't been taught that in our families. We haven't been taught that in the church. And then the organizations that do exist often are organizations that have been founded by individuals who, you know, very candidly don't always have our community's interests in mind. And so sometimes the fights get conflicted and the messages get conflicted because of who's paying the money so that people can have a salary. Hmm. And in Milwaukee, that has been a real problem for a long time. So I'm glad to see people rising up. But in something that Marquesa did say that I agree with is that we must channel the energy in a way that builds and doesn't destroy. This is a response to these systemic issues. And people are sick. People are Fannie Lou Hamer, sick and tired of being sick and tired. But we must channel it in a way that is collective, coordinated, strategic, and using and understanding the places where we have ability and we have not exercised it. So that's the frustrating part, is getting us to a place that the mixed messages that get put in our community because of who's paid for messages to be put in, we're fighting those and we're trying to educate and we're frustrated. So it's just so much that's going on. I always love to see people being engaged. That's my thing. And so I love that.
But I think that's what builds that opportunity. The education has to be continual, right? Even in moments where we feel like, you know, there's no reward, there's nothing that is coming out of this, there's nothing being produced, or those moments where we're feeling weary and frustrated and tired, our educational efforts have to be continual because of the fact that we understand that this is going to take, you know, this is chess, it's not checkers, right? And then plus, you know, there's an easy answer to a complex problem that's always the wrong one. We cannot always assume that because we are providing this service in this moment, that suddenly everybody has it and that we can start moving forward. No, there's going to be some times where there's got to be some repetition. There's got to be some times where we have to continuously grind and push some of those same messages. And I think that's what helps to counter some of the messages that have been conflicting in our communities when we are constantly pushing a unified, universal message regularly so people can understand this is exactly where we want to take our communities. But the minute where we have those gaps in messaging and in educational efforts, that's when the conflicting messages come in and are able to really take our community to another level, to a different direction. So these efforts have to be continual. They've got to be regular. They've got to be really intentional in how we're doing it. And I think that's what, you know, to the point to Marquesa, what Marquesa is saying, of being really, really strategic about how those messages look and there being a constant effort across the board.
And since we talked about just conflicting messages, I think we should also talk about the protesters versus the looting that comes out of that. And just because I've seen so many comments on social media just saying this isn't the way, or as you guys mentioned, you know, we always talk about Black people need to wait or take down a notch. But people just, they're like, why is the looting happening? You know, it's taking away from the original, you know, civil rights message. Do you guys see the looting happening in conjunction with protests? Do you see that taken away from the original message? And why is looting something we see every time this happens?
It's a part of the message. It's not taken away from the message. It's a part of the message. To me, it's like, it's just another, this is an octopus. So it's just another arm of the message. And I can't say, you know, what people should be doing in this moment. If I haven't reached out my grasp and my network and my net enough to create and develop more leaders to get to these young people. Like, people be begging, you know, for people to take on mentorship. I know Linnell Rainey, he's working in an organization, the Bucks Mentorship, begging people to mentor people. If you haven't taken time to sit down and develop some of these young people, to take time to go into pour into them, to take time to be a part of creating spaces so that when these things can happen, we have people in place who can go and shift the energy to do something. So if people who are on social media, you know, on the radio, in the media, wherever, have anything to say and they haven't done that, they can be quiet. That's my response to that. If you haven't taken any stances enough to do that, then you don't have any space to really say anything because you haven't provided guidance. You haven't connected to mentorship opportunities. You haven't connected to organizers to figure out how can I respond to some of the demands and the requests around the budget and on the state level and lobbying to ensure we have places to plug people in through this energy. And until things change on this planet, there's always going to be this response, no matter what.
If I can, my response to that is we understand through child development that usually a traumatized child tends to, you know, really act out, do things that, you know, could be considered potentially risky or, you know, all of that type of stuff. But we know it's a result of the trauma that they've experienced and they're hurting. So why is it that we can understand that young people or children do that, but not believe that that can happen to somebody when they're an adult? Or when they're teenagers, why do we think that that suddenly stops and that trauma doesn't impact people just because they've gotten older? We have to understand that trauma impacts people in multiple forms, regardless of age. And what you're seeing is the anger that is being produced from that trauma. So people are using the looting conversation as a means to deflect from the actual truth of why that has happened. And I believe that they are connected. Now, again, you know, we don't want to see the fires in our community. We don't want to see that. But at the same time, I understand why that happens. And if we're not going to be willing to address the root causes as to why we got there, then there shouldn't be any comments. If it's all about that doesn't make any sense and why they doing what they do and how come they just always make this a race and how come we don't talk about black on black crime and all that. All those are diversion tactics to get away from exactly what the true reasoning is as to why these things are happening. So when we see a lot of the, you know, the protests and they're getting, you know, loud, they're getting rambunctious, they're riling up and all that, and the frustration is coming out, that's what you're seeing. You're seeing the frustration of generational and current trauma that has been perpetuated by white supremacy and racism. So that's got to be the conversation. Stop focusing on the symptom and focus on the actual root causes as to why it happened.
All the time, the root.
The root. And, you know, I want to say something else. It is true that people need to start with their own actions. As, you know, Marquesa said, it is true that the trauma is deep and the amount of trauma that exists in this community is so complex, you know, that's a whole nother conversation. There hasn't been funding for mental health. There's been a stigma around mental health. There hasn't been any adequate services related to that. So all of that is true.
Have you seen a response like this in past years? And if not, like, does this seem like a turning point?
I definitely think we saw it during Mike Brown. I think that people rose up across the country when this happened to Mike Brown. I remember when we rose up in Milwaukee and did that, you know, with supporting the Coalition for Justice and Dontre Hamilton's family. So, no, I just think that this is, you know, we keep leveling up, though. we keep leveling up, you know, and in the interim of those times in between, like, groups are developing more tactics, groups are using more tools, groups are getting more resources, more leaders are coming into power, and we're shifting things. And each time it's just a new level up. So I feel like we are in this great place. Like I said, I'm just excited. We're in a great place for another level up to what it's going to look like to get the things that we want to address those root causes, to invest in our people so that our people can live and be at their best. So I think we're just leveling up.
I think we saw this same momentum around Alton Sterling with Philando Castile as well, because of the fact that those two were also recorded. Especially, you know, when everybody learned that Philando Castile, and see, and that's another thing that we're not talking about. When we do comply, we still get killed. Like, Philando Castile did everything right. He informed the officer of what he had. He told him he was CCW. He told him that he had his firearm, and he was still killed. So it's like, when we do comply and we quote unquote follow the rules, there's still complaints and we still get killed. So it's almost like, at what point do you think we're just going to continue going in the way that we have been going? But I digress. I think the momentum was just as high, just as pertinent and powerful during the, like Marquez said, the Mike Brown, but then also with the Alton Sterling, Philando Castile. Momentum was really strong there, because we saw movements happening across the country and even across the world, especially for Philando Castile. So I think that, you know, that's just going to continue to build. It's unfortunate that we have to keep doing these types of movements, because we keep experiencing this racism, but at the same time, we're going to keep fighting until we finally get what we fundamentally deserve. We're not just requesting what we deserve, we're demanding what we deserve.
I would like for you guys to share what you all hope comes from this at the end of the day.
I hope that more of us can get on the same page strategically. I hope that more of us are taking responsibility for pouring into the generations behind us and around us. I hope that the churches would stop being quiet and walking this power that they say that they have, like in real life. I hope that we are building on top of the foundations that we've been a part of building on ourselves, and, you know, the ancestors that shoulders that I stand on, that we are building just another foundation to level up, to get some of the things that we want, and to continue to work at dismantling the systems that have oppressed our people. So I'm just wanting to continue to level up and not repeat some of the same mistakes that have been made here in Milwaukee or across the nation when it comes to organizing and leading people around the work that we're doing. So I hope that as well, that my daughter is not still fighting some of these same fights. Like, that's not what's up. You know, what's up is that I will be able to pass her the baton, and that she'll be working on a greater level of this work. You know, what it looks like to have complete alternatives to policing, you know, living in a whole nother world, you know, the worlds that we said that we imagine and we're thinking about and we're dreaming about. She's actually a part of living in that along with my nephew.
I think she said it well.
Thank you guys so much for taking this time for this conversation. Stay safe out here.
Thank you so much. Y'all be safe as well.
Support for Race and Ethnicity Reporting is provided by the Doman Company Foundation.
Marquesa Tucker is the director of the African American Roundtable. State Senator Lena Taylor represents Wisconsin's 4th District. And Jamal Smith is the Violence Prevention Manager at the Milwaukee Office of Violence Prevention. They all spoke with WEWM's race and ethnicity reporter Taryn Powell about the weekend protests. For more about the protests in Milwaukee and around the country, you can go to WUWM.com. Coming up next, we'll air a special edition of NPR's podcast, Code Switch. Lake Effect Weekend continues in just a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. As we've been talking about on the show today, the death of George Floyd and other unarmed Black Americans has sparked outrage around the country. And for many, these deaths at the hands of police are frustratingly familiar. In light of the mass demonstrations, Lake Effect is airing a special presentation of NPR's podcast, Code Switch. It examines how the rise in social media and video recordings have forced the country to face and acknowledge police brutality against Black people. Gene Dimby and Shireen Marisol Meraji host an episode called A Decade of Watching Black People Die.
Just a heads up, this episode contains language and content that may be disturbing to some listeners. I'm Gene Dimby.
I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji, and this is Code Switch.
From NPR.
The family of a Kentucky woman shot and killed by police is demanding answers.
The former cop and his son, both white, are accused of killing the unarmed Black man.
We begin with the breaking news from Minneapolis. Violent protests raged for a second straight night following the death of George Floyd after being arrested by a Minneapolis police officer. Last night, protesters turned their attention to the city's third police precinct.
The last few weeks have been filled with devastating news. Stories about police killing Black people. And what is sick is that these stories have become the kind of news that we in the business call evergreen. They're stories that are always relevant and always in season.
These calamities are so familiar at this point that their details have begun to echo each other. In July 2014, a cell phone video captured some of Eric Garner's final words as New York City police officers sat on his head and pinned him to the ground on a city sidewalk. I can't breathe. On May 25th of this year, those same words were spoken by George Floyd just before he died. He pleaded for release as an officer kneeled on his neck and pinned him to the ground on a Minneapolis city street. So we're at the point where the verbiage people use to plead for their lives can be repurposed as shorthand for completely different stories.
And part of our job here at Code Switch is to contextualize and make sense of news like this. But Gene, it's hard to come up with something new to say, you know, things we haven't already said or things we haven't already recorded protesters saying when we were both in Ferguson in August of 2014 after Michael Brown was killed by the police, or when we were in Baltimore after Freddie Gray's death. I spent the day with junior high school kids in West Baltimore, where Freddie Gray was from, on the first day they let kids return to school after all the protests, and I will never forget the eighth grade boy who raised his hand to ask, "Why have white people been killing us since slavery? And they're still killing us." He said that on Wednesday, April 29th, 2015.
Since it's so hard to come up with any fresh insights about this phenomenon, we thought we would look back to another time when the nation turned its collective attention to this perpetual problem.
I'm Jamil Smith, senior writer for Rolling Stone magazine. And when I was at the New Republic, I wrote an article entitled, "What Does Seeing Black Men Die Do For You?" It was published on April 13th, 2015. We get to see Black men tortured or killed by police a lot more often these days. So it's worth recalling why, a generation ago, it mattered so much to see what happened to Rodney King.
Now the story that might never have surfaced if someone hadn't picked up his home video camera. We've all seen the picture.
We had certainly seen the black and white photographs and videos depicting police abuse of African Americans. And we'd seen the grainy images of lynchings past. But the conventional ignorance was that this wasn't the America we lived in now.
Police officers beating a man they had just pulled over.
This was the early 90s, after all. This was an America that viewed law enforcement in the context of the popular reality show Cops, and where Morton Downey Jr.'s tabloid television style made uncensored aggression a form of entertainment. But when George Holliday's video surfaced,
struck him with batons of between 53 and 56 times.
It signaled to a lot of citizens just how bad police violence visited upon marginalized communities actually was.
Six kicks and one officer, one kick.
People either didn't know what was happening or were willfully ignorant of it. They needed to wake up.
say the Los Angeles Police Department has a history of brutality and misconduct that goes back a quarter of a century.
Today, we are not sure that the police is there to protect us.
The fear of becoming the next Rodney King is still here. But what has changed is how often we are viewing that fear being realized.
Jamil goes on to write that the ubiquity of cell phone cameras and dashboard cameras means this uncensored horror has become available on demand.
He says he watched 22-year-old Oscar Grant get shot and killed by a police officer on YouTube before it made it to broadcast news. That happened in Oakland in 2009 on New Year's Day. And it really marked the beginning of this grim genre.
In which the slain become memorialized as hashtags. Hashtag justice for Oscar Grant. And remember Walter Scott and Eric Harris? Jamil writes that the videos of them being killed became public almost back to back in 2015.
Both men were running away when the shots were fired. Walter Scott, 50, was trying to escape North Charleston police officer Michael Slager, who shot him 8 times in the back before planting evidence near his body to support a false account of the incident. Eric Harris was running from a team of Tulsa County deputies when elderly insurance executive Robert Bates, whose donations to the sheriff's office and modicum of training earned him the title of reserve deputy, shot him dead. Scott's death looks even more brazen than the inexcusable shooting of 12-year-old Tamir Rice in a Cleveland park last November. In fact, many of the videos carry eerie and terrible echoes of previous incidents. As in Oscar Grant III's death in 2009, Bates claimed he meant to pull his taser, not his gun, before shooting Harris. Eric Garner's futile cry was evoked when the mortally wounded Harris yelled, "I'm losing my breath."
Your breath.
Bates' fellow deputy responded. The police dashboard video of Floyd Dent's traffic stop in Inkster, Michigan, 3 months ago, brought to mind the brutal beating of Rodney King. Officer William Melendez, as the tape shows, began beating Dent savagely almost as soon as the 57-year-old motorist was pulled from his vehicle.
He's seen punching Floyd Dent 16 times in just 10 seconds.
Melendez was suspended for 5 days last Friday. And a report out of Detroit's ABC affiliate says he could lose his job. Slager was fired by his department and charged with Scott's murder.
Michael Slager was sentenced to 20 years in prison.
We see these arrests and firings as victories in the struggle for Black liberation from police violence. But how much will an oversaturation of videotaped Black death move our justice system and government to action? Dozens of Rodney Kings haven't been enough to move the needle significantly. The videos have helped spur civic protest, which surely have led to more media attention and perhaps legal action. But they haven't slowed the rate of killings, nor made the officers responsible more accountable. Instead, we face a continued insistence from many that we live in a properly policed America, despite video evidence. That rosy-hued narrative gets a boost from current and former law enforcement professionals like Howard Safir, who came to the defense of good cops in Time magazine after Scott's death. Quote, "Our citizens gain nothing from demoralized police forces that believe they do not have public support," unquote, wrote the former NYPD commissioner. Quote, "Demoralized forces will not be as effective as they can be. And that would have a tremendously negative impact on public safety," unquote. Keep in mind that we just watched an unarmed man gunned down from behind, then handcuffed and framed for an assault as he lay dying. It was later disclosed that Slager experienced an adrenaline rush from shooting. And I'm supposed to be worried about whether the cop feels like I've got his back. We keep pouring on the visuals and re-traumatizing ourselves, hoping it'll break through similarly reflexive defenses of law enforcement and inspire real reform. People like Fiden Santana, who recorded Scott's death, continue to risk their own safety to record these incidents and expose open wounds, literally, in the hopes that someone will do something. Corporate media outlets have grasped the importance, or at least the consumer appeal, of this footage. Activists, journalists, and concerned citizens continue to spread these images throughout social media to alarm and inspire.
Let him go!
But to what end? After Scott's death, Time magazine felt the need to declare on its cover that Black Lives Matter. That statement, still inspirational to many, can seem like an awfully low floor for social advancement. Black people have been telling the white power structure that I am a man since at least the 1968 Memphis sanitation strike. America has taken its sweet time in granting Black victims this mild degree of humanization. But despite actually seeing the brutalization of our bodies in more vivid detail than ever before, the police and government have remained unmoved. I tremble to think what act or accompanying footage will be required for the powers that be to finally see what is going on. As I revisit this piece, a little bit more than 5 years after I wrote it, I'm astonished by how much of it I could put into a column today.
More on that after the break.
Stay with us.
Lake Effect will continue in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers.
Just a heads up, this episode contains language and content that may be disturbing to some listeners.
Shireen,
Gene,
Code Switch, and we're back with Jameel Smith. In 2015, he wrote, "What does seeing Black men die do for you?"
And he says that so much of that piece can be written using the same words today, 5 years later, especially the ending.
America is still taking its sweet time in even recognizing our humanity in terms of its laws, in terms of its mores, in terms of its practices. And I say America in a larger sense, not simply the law enforcement folks who would spray tear gas on protesters outraged by George Floyd's death in Minneapolis, lying screaming for his mother and his life under the knee, the literal knee of law enforcement. These folks having tear gas shot at them during a pandemic that attacks our pulmonary system, a pandemic that's attacking Black communities disproportionately. The power of that image especially when juxtaposed when the armed demonstrators in Michigan threatening lawmakers in an effort to essentially want to die faster or want the right to die faster is a real encapsulation of where we are in this country and the fact that we have not moved an inch since these videos became so popular. So we have to understand, what is their value? When are we going to see the kind of change that this kind of shock and awe should be provoking? If I were allowed to change anything 5 years after writing this column, I realize that there are a lot of contemporary references within it. And I think that's helpful for people who are reading it at the time. However, the reference to being the next Rodney King, it almost seems antiquated at this point. I think that, yes, my generation, Generation X, was afraid of being the next Rodney King. And I think that perhaps I based it a little bit too much in my own experience. I do think that there should have been maybe a little bit more grounding in the historical nature of how our bodies have been treated as souvenirs and our deaths been treated as something to be celebrated or even traded amongst people as postcards and pictures of our lynchings traded amongst the spectators, parts of our bodies after being flayed and burned, traded and sent to people and kept by the murderers. I think that when you look at these videos and you understand how little of an impact they've made on the policies required to make what's happening in those videos stop happening, those souvenirs, they don't really do much else other than traumatize us. The title of my column from April 2015 refers specifically to Black men. And at that time, we'd only seen videos of Black men dying or being accosted by the police. Of course, later we saw Sandra Bland, and we've seen so many other cases of Black women who have been victimized, who have been brutalized, and who have been killed by police, most often for no reason whatsoever, for no charge filed. Breonna Taylor in Kentucky has not received nearly the amount of press coverage or attention or even protest that George Floyd has in Minneapolis. The reasons for that may be traceable, of course, to gender. Are they also traceable to the fact that there was no video of the incident? Is this a case where video has relevance? These are things that we should be discussing. And I think we'd be foolish to dismiss gender as the primary cause of that. I think certainly, you know, we have normalized violence against women and against transgender women specifically to a point that is absurd. You know, the death of Nina Pop from stabbing earlier this year barely got any notice. And she was about the 10th or 11th victim of transgender violence in America this year. And we're not talking about it. We're not discussing this as an epidemic in our society. Why not? I think that, you know, everybody who is listening needs to go and look up these people. Look at their names. Look up their stories. Understand what happened to them. I will defer judgment on whether or not this is going to be the moment that finally everyone will understand exactly what's happening in the Black communities around this country with regards to policing and over-policing and militarized policing. After Ferguson, it's hard to hold your breath. It's hard to hold your breath when, you know, a 12-year-old kid gets gunned down with a toy gun in the city that you grew up in, as was the case for me with Tamir Rice. And the city kind of shrugs and everyone moves on. Tamir Rice would have been 18 in June. And America moves on. America moves forward. I think to a large extent, white power structure waits for us as Black people, especially, to quiet down, to settle down, to get it out of our system in terms of unrest or in terms of online protests. I'll be writing my column and that moment will happen. But whether or not it will result in any concrete change is really up to people who may be least involved with the trauma. It matters whether or not if people who are not affected by this do something.
This episode was produced by Kumari Devarajan and Jess Kung with help from Natalie Escobar. It was edited by Leah Donella and Shireen.
Shout out to the rest of the Code Switch fam, Karen Grigsby Bates, Alyssa Jong Perry, L.A. Johnson, and Steve Drummond. Our interns are Diane Lugo and Isabella Rosario.
I'm Gene Demby.
And I'm Shireen Marisol Meraji.
Be easy.
Peace.
Coming up next, contributor Sean Ramft shares his poem about his privilege as a white man living in America. You're listening to Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect Weekend continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Along with the discussions and marches for Black Lives Matter, another phrase people are learning more about is white privilege. It's a term that refers to the inherent advantages that come from being white in a culture with pervasive and enduring racial inequity. As a white man, our poetry contributor Sean Ranft has been reflecting on the recent protests, and he asks other white people to do the same. Here he is introducing his poem titled Privilege.
Now I'm going to read a poem that I wrote entitled Privilege in a bit here, but first I wanted to say a couple of things about it. All I ask is that you keep these things in mind while listening to the poem. Everybody knows that white people, myself included obviously, have benefited from privilege their entire lives. We don't need to keep telling everybody that because they've told us that for decades, for centuries. It's clear, it's fact, everybody knows it. So beyond acknowledging that, what are you doing? If you can protest, great, but if you are protesting, please do so knowing that you're there to support the Black community, not to pat yourselves on the back. If you're unable to protest, fine, donate. There are several bail funds you can donate to, Black Lives Matter chapters, countless other links, Black-owned businesses, anything to help. Share those links. Let people know where they can donate. There are several resources you can find online or buy to learn, to educate yourself on everything the Black community has had to deal with for hundreds of years. But I think the most important thing is to stop asking Black people to tell you what you can do, what we can do. We've been told. For hundreds of years, we've been told. Everything is online. You don't need to ask them to do the work for you. We have to do the work ourselves. So as you're listening to this poem, please just think about how what we're saying and what we're doing if that's enough. And please just think about how our entire lives have been a lot easier because of the skin we were born into. Don't forget that. This is privilege. Privilege is being able to say all lives matter while living out your day, while being without fear, while breathing without care as another struggles for air. They deflect from injustice. They remove from confrontation. Those three words, just a vicious reaction to those who simply want to be treated as human. Privilege is being able to wake up without constant dread in the back of your head. Privilege is being able to write this without ever knowing how dangerous it is just to breathe, just to be. Passive discomfort isn't an excuse for silence. Potential confrontation isn't an excuse for injustice. Privilege is being able to choose to do nothing. But yet, you tell yourself those three words, all lives matter, because you don't have to care, because you don't have to fear. They serve as a blanket, shielding you from the grim reality that dares to alter your ideals. Disingenuous at best, irreparably harmful at worst. That's privilege. We see the faces, we hear the voices, but we choose silence because it soothes, and it's long past time to convert comfort into confrontation. Privilege is being able to decide that you don't have to decide. And that's power you can't buy.
Sean Ranft is a poetry contributor for Lake Effect, and you can find more of his work at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4 on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.